This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch potatoes, across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Cars 3, 47 Meters Down, Rough Night, All Eyes on Me, with a Z, and Paris Can Wait. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and the home cinema roundup featuring the Lego Batman movie. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news is a sad piece of news that I actually missed right before the show last week, and that was the death of Adam West, who is the classic Batman from the 1960s. And Adam West was 88 years old. He had been doing a lot of stuff. He just didn't disappear in the 60s after doing Batman. I mean, it wasn't one of these things where he was this actor who faded into obscurity. Yeah, he did some goofy movies. He did some stuff that ended up on Mystery Science Theater. And what was great about Adam West, and Mystery Science Theater speaks to that, not just Batman. I mean, he always was game for Batman stuff. But more specifically, here was a guy who didn't take himself too seriously. He understood where he fit in terms of making movies. He understood that not everything he did was Shakespeare. And when he did this, I think it was Zombie Nightmare was the episode of Mystery Science Theater he appeared in. He ended up filming segments for the Mystery Science Theater people for their Turkey Day specials. Now, he did one year where he just did a guest appearance, and I think they had Mamie Van Doren show up from Girlstown, and they had Robert Vaughn show up. But then, like, the next year, Adam West did all the segments for Turkey Day. So here was a guy who was willing to do anything, willing to just have some fun and poke fun at some of the silly roles he's had in the past. And then he went on, a lot of people actually recognize his voice, not from Batman in the 60s, but from when he was on Family Guy, playing the mayor of the town, playing Adam West, a version of himself. And he had such a great presence and such a good sense of humor. I mean, he wasn't the original Batman because there was a guy who played him in the serials in the 1940s, but he was the first really noticeable Batman. And when they brought Batman to the big screen as its own movie in 1989 with Tim Burton and Jack Nicholson and Michael Keaton, I actually had a chance to meet Adam West. I mean, I was just a stupid high school kid, but they were doing a tour with the original Batmobile. Him and Burt Ward were driving. Well, I don't know how they drove in it. I don't think they were driving around the country in this thing, but they drove into this mall parking lot with the Batmobile and people stood in line and got autographs. It was hysterical because I got an autograph. I had Detective Comics 600, which was a tribute to Batman that had just came out a couple years before that. And Adam West had written a bit in there, like just a little paragraph. And they had a tribute page and I had him sign that. And then I'm like, I had nothing for Burt Ward to sign. And so Burt Ward was kind of like, sure, I'll sign the picture that we provide. But I mean, he was kind of irked at me because I made a bigger deal about Adam West. So, I mean, you know, forgive me, Burt Ward, but say what you want to about the character he played. I mean, with his satin cowl and his goofy cape and his dad bod with no ripped muscles whatsoever and his goody two-shoed Boy Scout attitude. Everyone always talks about Superman as the Boy Scout. He was the real Boy Scout. He didn't swear. He didn't use guns. He didn't use bad grammar. He didn't go over the speed limit. I mean, these are things that they actually pointed out in the TV show. When you look at the series of actors who played Batman after that, you had Michael Keaton, and then you had Val Kilmer and George Clooney, and then, of course, you know, very famously Christian Bale, and now Ben Affleck. Adam West is arguably the most iconic. His is the most memorable. I mean, you can't immediately pick out what made any of those other guys who played Batman later in the black leather pumped up suits. Adam West is one of the most recognizable Batmans ever. And that is a testament to what he's done because the show was so goofy. He even went on to do this thing called The Legends of the Superheroes, in which Ed McMahon roasted all the superheroes. And of course, Adam West and Burt Ward showed up as Batman and Robin. And that was brilliant. So You know, it's very sad to see Adam West go, because he was always kind of still around and always game for this stuff. And talk about somebody who's made an indelible mark in pop culture and probably wasn't expecting to when he took the role. So we're going to miss you, Adam West. The next piece of news is a little bit I found. Apparently, Patty Jenkins was interviewed and had a response to people questioning, was Wonder Woman's tone changed because the other movies, Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman, and Suicide Squad, were those considered too dark? And she kind of pushed back on it. I'm not going to give you the quotes, but she ultimately said she wanted to just make an authentic origin story and that the studio didn't tell her how to do the tone. I think what it goes to show is this is what needed to happen with Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman was not and isn't a dark character. Wonder Woman's always had a level of optimism to her. And she's always been a fighter for the small guy or the small woman. This isn't a direct pushback to what Zack Snyder did in making these movies dark, but it's certainly a testament that shows when people see a superhero movie, they want some optimism and humor and looking upward instead of looking downward. How they rectify all this with her being done with mankind and the human race as she was in the beginning of Batman versus Superman, we'll see. I'm curious to see where that goes, because they may just dial back from that and ignore it completely and just make her ready to have pounced. She was done and she was dark and gritty then, but I don't think they want to show her getting that dark and gritty unless there's a real reason for it. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to talk about is Coco, the new Pixar movie, opening on November 22nd.
What's going on? I'm just dreaming.
Miguel?
What is going on?
Remind me how I know you?
They're your family.
Have to get you back home.
Welcome. Anything to declare?
As a matter of fact, yes.
This is actually the second movie made about the Mexican Day of the Dead in like the last 5 years or so. In fact, the first one came out, and that was actually Guillermo del Toro was involved in it. And I believe it was a Fox animation production, which was a good movie in its own right. And the imagery that you have in The Day of the Dead can be very scary. And I think it's taken so long to make these movies because there's a real finesse you have so you don't terrify your audience, because these are kids' movies. Now, Coco seems to know what it's doing. Coco seems to just sort of say, hey, this isn't scary at all. They're not even pretending it was scary. They're not even pretending it looks creepy, even though it does. And I think that's the best way to do it, because kids accept how you approach things. If you approach something as not being scary, they're going to have the bravery that they just glom off of you. But I think it's neat that they're, you know, it's a cultural thing that is going to be given a good treatment in theater. So I'm looking forward to this one. I'm curious to see how they make this one work. The other one I want to talk about is Black Panther, which opens on February 16th of next year.
What do you know about Wakanda?
It's a third world country.
All the front. I'm the only one who's seen it and made it out alive.
The world is changing. Soon, there will only be the conquered and the conquerors.
The trailer looks really good. And my biggest thing that I worry about with Black Panther is that there's going to be no humor in it. And there needs to be a certain tone that Marvel generally has. And that was my problem with the character that in the Civil War movie, he was a little bit grim and just had not a shred of humor to him. And I hope that they have that in there, because that's essential for Marvel movies. And you don't want it to just be this grim, heavy, dour movie. So I'm looking forward to it. I mean, I'll grant it. A lot of people are saying this is the first black superhero. It's not. I mean, it's even in the Marvel Universe, it's its own first movie. But, you know, to go tell that to War Machine and Falcon, who, you know, Don Cheadle and Anthony Mackie already have a black Avenger in there. But this is the first one that gets his own movie, even though Blade was made 20-some years ago with Wesley Snipes, and that wasn't in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This is, of course, pointing out the same holes in the narrative that people had when they said Wonder Woman is the first female superhero movie. I'm like, really? Tell that to Elektra and Catwoman. But still, this one looks like it's a good movie. I'm looking forward to it. that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about 47 Meters Down and All Eyes on Me. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's start off with the movie reviews. I'm going to start off with 47 Meters Down. Two sisters vacationing in Mexico go on an excursion in which they're lowered in a cage into shark-infested waters only to have the winch break, sending them plummeting to the ocean floor.
It's like you're going to the zoo, except you're in the cage.
I don't know about this.
Welcome aboard.
We would like to come back up now.
How deep are we?
47 meters.
Hello, is anyone there? Please, someone answer me!
We have to get back up to the top.
Stay in the cage.
We have no air. We have to go now.
You know, it's turned into a thing recently that it's not a summer until you have a shark attack movie. Whether it's going to be something goofy like Sharknado on TV or Sharktopus, or if it's going to be an authentic scary shark movie. Like last year we had The Shallows. That may have come out later in the summer, but still, it was a good shark attack movie. And this one's a good shark attack movie as well. Before I even start, of course, everybody immediately starts comparing it to Jaws because it's a shark movie. And that's fair. There's nothing wrong with comparing this to Jaws. It's like having a space opera and comparing it to Star Wars or a superhero movie and comparing it to a Marvel movie or the Superman movies. But the thing that really makes a difference in shark attack movies now, even for something as goofy as Sharknado, you have to admit that the animation of the sharks in Sharknado, while they're not perfect and while they have some flaws to them, they still look actually pretty good if you compare them to like Bruce the Shark, which was the original shark in Jaws, the model they had. And Jaws is still a great movie because of the suspense and the way they make it. And they couldn't use the shark model. They couldn't use Bruce a lot because he broke down. So they had to make the movie about the people. And that's why Jaws, I think, will always continue to be the quintessential shark movie. What's nice about movies now is animation and computer generation programs have gotten so good that you can make a movie that looks very authentic and you can put realistic looking sharks in these movies. Cause I'm watching the sharks on screen and I'm like, that looks real. And I know in Jaws, they actually shot a miniature cage with a real full size great white shark. But here, these are generated in the computer, but they look great. And now it's interesting with this film because I think it was originally supposed to just go direct to DVD or video on demand. And when you watch the characters in the story, it's pretty clear. I mean, Mandy Moore and it plays this older sister who's just broken up with her boyfriend and her and her sister down in Mexico trying to party their sadness away. But there's not a whole lot of good character development. There's not great dialogue. There's not great acting in the film. You got to get through that initial 20 minutes of the movie, which are quite frankly pretty insipid and boring. You just have to kind of get past it. And that's fine because once you get to the shark moments and once you get to the scary parts, it actually really picks up. You know, whenever you're reminded of the story and the character and the acting, it kind of goes by the wayside. But once they get to the water, it's pretty harrowing because these are things that really happen. These are real excursions that are sort of done by just some guy with a boat that don't have any sort of licensing or any sort of approval or any sort of governing body making sure that they're doing stuff safely. And this stuff happens and bad things happen on these excursions all the time. And I've been on good excursions that are where I feel like I'm safe, but I wouldn't want to go on an excursion like this. It's kind of a brilliantly made movie because it takes place, most of it mostly takes place at the bottom of the ocean, which is 47 meters down. Now, when you're down that far, the light density is very, very little, so you can't see very far. So it's clear they just filmed this thing in a tank. But because you don't need to see very far and it needs to be obscured, it actually worked. And they also do one of these things where they kind of fall into a trap that Jaws fell into, which actually helped it out, is I think the shark effects were very expensive, because especially if they're going to make it on the big screen, you know, it's got to, you know, it's got to withstand looking good on a screen 20 feet tall. And so when they have the sharks you don't see all that often. They're actually very calculated and put in only at certain times. And there's really not a whole lot of screen time on the sharks. But that actually works out because it forces them to build the suspense. It forces them to really make it work from these girls' points of view, because not only are they stuck on the bottom of the ocean, which is dangerous enough because you can't just swim to the surface because you'll get the bends. They got sharks above them, sharks around them. And then they've also got to deal with the fact that they're running out of air, because they're in scuba gear and you're at the bottom of the ocean. You have no way to breathe. You can suffocate. So it's sort of this triple threat here that really works. And I mean, it gets silly and absurd at times, but I'll tell you, the underwater scares and sequences are what saves this movie. And if you can get past sort of some goofy acting, some bad story, it's a nice little thrill ride. It's a nice little escape. It's one of those movies that you'd want to go see in a pool, maybe not in the open ocean. So I'm going to have to say 47 Meters Down kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is All Eyes on Me, with a Z, E-Y-E-Z. The life and controversial career of rapper Tupac Shakur is examined in this biopic.
We love your music, Tupac. You paint a picture for the listener. It's not always pretty, but it's real.
I'm reporting from the streets. I'm educating and keeping it real.
I have an ungood authority that the FBI has a 4,000-page file on you.
Only 4,000, huh?
There are three things wrong with gangster rap. It is obscene.
You're trying to start a positive movement for black people by using negative symbolism like thug and outlaw.
You got to enter in somebody's world in order to lead.
I am a contemporary of Tupac Shakur. I remember when he was just really becoming hitting in the mainstream. I never listened to rap, so I was unaware of any sort of existence of any sort of East Coast versus West Coast, because that's not the music I listened to when I was in college and high school. But I do remember when he was making inroads into popular culture, like when he did the movie Poetic Justice with Janet Jackson back in what, like early 90s. So I've never knowingly listened to any of his music. I'm not into rap, but I do remember what a big deal it was when he was a rapper trying to get his acting career off, and then when he got killed. So I'm aware of this, but I never really knew much about it. Now, I was talking with somebody once who said that they were hoping that this would have as much of an impact as Straight Outta Compton. And I said, probably it wouldn't, because I don't think Tupac had the range and the reaching of his celebrity outside of the sort of hip hop community. NWA, say what you want to about their music, they certainly transcended their own race. They transcended their own socioeconomic level. Their music was listened to by a lot of people who weren't just in Compton, California. And while Tupac certainly had an audience, if he hadn't been killed, he might have had, same thing with like the Notorious B.I.G. If they had not been killed, they probably would have had even bigger careers, and they would have gone on to be more well-known outside of just, you know, sort of like that Death Row Records sphere of influence. But they were, and I don't know anything about this movie because they didn't screen it for us. And it famously wasn't screened, I don't think, for anybody. I'm wondering if they thought it was critic-proof. I don't know. Generally, when they don't screen a movie, especially something like this, I mean, they screened Straight Outta Compton. It was a different studio, but they screened Straight Outta Compton, and that did very well. So it's not like they were afraid of white reviewers, and it's not like a Madea movie, which often are not screened, because they know that that's sort of got its own niche market for his audience. So it confounds me when they don't screen something like this, and I didn't have a chance to see it. I'm going to have to give it a preemptive suck, but I imagine if you're a fan of Tupac Shakur, you'll probably enjoy it. But for me, it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Rough Night and Paris Can Wait. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare.
In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Live fast, die young, bad girls do it well. Live fast, die young, bad girls do it well. Live fast, die young, bad girls do it well.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. The first one I want to hit this time around is Rough Night. A group of college friends gather in Miami for a bachelorette party, only to accidentally kill a stripper and try to figure out what to do next.
Hello?
Hey, I am so psyched for your bachelorette weekend.
Mommy, do you have to go to Miami?
I really do.
Here and I'm ready to attack.
This weekend's all about us, just like old times.
He's here! My turn!
Oh, God. He's dead. Okay.
They got me on the rails in the air.
I know that things are crazy right now, but you're gonna have a lot of material for my wedding speeches.
For years, Hollywood has been trying to do the female version of The Hangover, but they've struggled to get a female version of The Hangover. And I think it was they run on the same problems that a lot of movies when they try to make a female version of guys behaving badly movies. And we saw this with Neighbors 2. They treat it more as an empowerment for women to behave badly, when really the movies with the men who behave badly, they're all trying to overcome the mistakes they made. Whereas in these female empowerment movies about women behaving badly, it's sort of a triumph for the women to behave badly. And that's not appealing, I don't think. Only to the raging neo-feminism of today's modern movie culture does that work. Because, like I said, in The Hangover, they get tricked into getting hungover, and it's them embarrassed and feeling bad for having all this crazy stuff that's gone on, and they're trying to fix all the wrongs. Whereas, you know, like in a, you would expect the way they would do them now would be to have a female version where they have a hangover and like, yeah, we were partying and we were terrible people. So that was my original worry about Rough Night. I said, oh God, this is just going to be more of that. And in fact, if you look at the storyline, this is very similar. There were two movies that came out in the 90s. One was called Stag and one was called Very Bad Things. And they basically had the same plot. It was a bachelor party where a stripper gets killed. Now, in one of them, an actual adult film actress, Kobe Tai, play the stripper, and she gets accidentally killed having sex with one of the guys. And then they go into this whole thing trying to hide it. And then the other one, they had a guy actually shoot a stripper. So it was less of an accident in that movie. But in both of them, you just felt like when you watch these movies, you felt like you wanted to have a shower because these guys were so sleazy, especially in how they dealt with the problem of a dead stripper. I mean, gosh, if I had a nickel for every time I had to deal with a dead stripper in my life, you don't want to know how much money I'd have. But anyways, in the movie Rough Night, the approach they take is different, and it's not a sense of empowerment, which is actually kind of good. It's just women going crazy, but it's done in an absurdist, crazy, over-the-top comedy sort of way. Both Stag and Very Bad Things were not that. They sort of turned into dark dramas, especially once the hooker was killed in those movies. Now, in this film, you do have to do a little bit of moral gymnastics to swallow what they're giving you in this one. You do have to sort of push down a little bit of basic human decency because there's everybody there going, what should we do? Can we hide the body? Should we call somebody? Should we turn ourselves in? And I understand the panic that you'd feel when, you know, something like that would happen. But you should get to the point of saying, you know, we need to call somebody if there is a dead body that we're responsible for. They do kind of do some backflips to get around it, but it's all kind of framed in an absurd level. And so I found myself able to get past that a little bit easier than I have in other movies. The biggest reason is this actually has some funny bits to it. It's has some very funny moments, has some very funny ladies in it. Scarlett Johansson's good, but she knows her place. She's not a raucous comedian, so she does the reactionary comedy. And you've got people like Jillian Bell, who really is the center of the comedy in this one. Now, you've got Kate McKinnon, which I know she's very popular now, and I know a lot of people love to talk about her. I found her just wildly annoying in this movie. I think that Kate McKinnon does some brilliant stuff. If you watch the stuff she's done on Saturday Night Live, especially during the election year, playing Hillary Clinton and playing Jefferson Sessions, I mean, she does some pretty outrageous and funny bits. But in her movies, it's been blowing hot and cold. And of course, she was really good in Ghostbusters, not terribly good in movies like that one she did with Zach Galifianakis. I can't even remember the name of it, but it was bad. And at times, she is just awkwardly not good. Now, she plays this woman who's Australian, and it seems like half the jokes are predicated on a bad accent done by Kate McKinnon. And I didn't find that funny. It seems like every time she stepped up to do something, it kind of just killed the moment. Jillian Bell sets things up brilliantly. And then Kate McKinnon stabs a knife in it and dies. So I didn't like Kate McKinnon in this really at all, but I thought Jillian Bell was a hoot. And it's great to see her actually get kind of that lead role in a movie, because she's always been relegated to a side character, whether it's 22 Jump Street or whether it's Office Christmas Party or whether it's Fist Fight. She does some great stuff. And it was great to see her doing some good and funny bits. So I don't necessarily feel like a better person for laughing a lot in this movie. But I did. I found it funny. And, you know, it's not for everybody. It's very R-rated. And like I said, you kind of have to push down some basic human decency to find certain things funny. You got to have a dark, dark corner of your mind and heart to enjoy this movie. But I guess I do. So I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Next movie I want to talk about is Paris Can Wait. The wife of a movie executive takes a road trip from Cannes to Paris with her husband's colleague.
I think I should skip Budapest and just go straight to Paris.
I'm driving back now. May I make a suggestion? I'll take care of her.
That's very generous, but are you sure it's okay with you?
So let's pretend we don't know where we're going, or even who we are.
Oh, brother.
Driving is the only way to see a country.
How's Paris?
I'm actually not there yet. Jack wanted to stop for the night.
He what?
Santé.
Don't forget, he's a Frenchman.
This one stars one of my favorite actresses of all time, Diane Lane. And even though she's in her 50s now, I still think she's a beautiful woman. And I've always had a thing for Diane Lane ever since I saw her in A Perfect Romance when I was, you know, I was like 10 and she was in this movie. And I mean, I think she's a great actress and she's one of the most beautiful women in Hollywood. And she's, of course, now that she's in her 50s, she's having to take roles that are, you know, either Superman's mom or she's got to go up a little farther up the line and, you know, play like Alec Baldwin's wife. This film is directed by Eleanor Coppola, and that is the wife of Francis Ford Coppola. It makes a lot of sense when you know what the movie's about. I mean, I imagine that there are plenty of times that Eleanor Coppola has been places with her husband that are gorgeous, wonderful places that everyone wants vacation to, like the South of France, and has to deal with the fact that he's doing work and he's doing business and isn't really attentive to her. So in a way, this feels a bit like a fantasy of hers and a bit of her working through some things about their marriage. So I get where that's coming from, and it's better that it's made by her instead of like one of her, you know, like for Sofia Coppola, this would just come from a point of privilege, but this is really just kind of her along for the ride because her husband has the dominant career in their family. This is a bit of a travelogue of France. I mean, to the point that it becomes a little bit annoying. If you've ever seen the movie The Trip or The Trip to Italy, and I think there's another one that they did, is Steve Coogan and Rob Broyton do the series of sort of partly improv movies where they travel across the country in Europe and stop at different places and eat. And it's really to show the countryside and to show the great food that's available in the region. And it really just exists, I think, for Coogan and Brinton to have a vacation and get somebody to pay for it. And that's kind of what this felt like. It felt like it was partly sponsored by the French Department of Tourism because they were sure they'd go on about their wines and their cheeses and why they're better than anything else in the world and their chocolates and their desserts and their French restaurants, and it just really lays it on thick, and it's a little bit pushy in that respect. Now, the only thing that really saves it is the charm of Diane Lane, but it still feels a bit forced. There's a critic I know in Columbus. His name's John DeSando, and I said to him after the screening, I'm like, you loved this movie, didn't you? Because it's all what he loves. He loves people sitting around and talking, and he loves going to France. That's the kind of person you have to be to like that movie. But, you know, it runs a breezy like 92 minutes, so it's not like it's overly plotting, but, you know, it's fine for what it is. It's not exactly my cup of tea. But like I said, the charm of Diane Lane certainly helped raise it above what it could have been. So I'm going to have to say Paris Can Wait kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Cars 3, the weekly box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring the Lego Batman. Let's go! There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue with the final movie review. This one is a kids movie, and as I've been doing over this summer, when there's been a kids movie, and particularly an animated film, I like to bring in my son, Nicholas Carr, who's 9, to help me review it and tell people what's up with it. Say hi to the audience.
Hello, mates.
Hello. Is that your new thing?
Yes.
You're not British, though.
No,
he's not British. He just watches some British programming now and then, which is cool. It's PBS. It's educational. We do that. It's probably not PBS, though.
No.
You don't have to agree so much. You're going to get me in trouble. All right. The last film that we're going to review is Cars 3, which is the new Disney Pixar movie. After a devastating crash in a race against technologically superior new cars, Lightning McQueen travels back to Radiator Springs to find his center and race again.
We can only hope that this race today wasn't his last.
I decide when I'm done.
How you feeling?
I can't go out on the track and do the same old thing. It won't work.
Jackson Storm set a new record today when he pulled off the fastest lap ever recorded.
How you feeling?
Have you seen the latest record Storm's been set?
Have you given any thought to retirement?
McQueen, over here.
This is my last chance, Cruz. Last. If I lose, I never get to do this again.
Okay, first of all, I want to hear what you have to say about this.
I love it. I have always loved all the Cars movies.
Which did you like better, first one or second one?
I liked the second one because a lot of the cars from Radiator Springs came to London and, like, fought.
You liked the action movie angle to part two, right?
Yes.
Were you bothered by Mater? Do you like Mater as a character?
Yes.
See, now, I know this. There's a lot of critics I know who really dumped on Cars 2 because they didn't like the guy who plays Mater. Because it was more about Mater, and there's a lot of people who don't like Larry the Cable Guy in terms of reviewers. But you didn't care. You liked Mater. You liked the movie, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, what did you think of this one?
It was a change from a lot of them.
How so?
Because Lightning McQueen used to be the fastest car in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Then Jackson Storm showed up and sped through all of them. I actually remembered Jackson Storm's name.
I'm impressed. That cocky son of a piston was driving real fast. He was a next-gen car.
Yes.
What I found interesting is they go back to what Cars 1 was very much about. Or, you know, he suffers a defeat or he suffers a setback. He goes out in the middle of nowhere to Radiator Springs and sort of bonds with his friends and gets to find himself and sort of get himself recentered. And that's pretty much what happened here. He goes other places.
Yes.
Like, he goes to this new training facility. Now, you've loved all the Cars movies.
Yes.
You're a huge fan. Your mom likes them, too.
Yeah. We have, like, a Cars figure going upstairs.
Well, and that's what's interesting, because even though these movies don't make the most money in terms of box office, these are incredibly well-marketed. You have so much Cars material. You have, like, Cars slippers, right?
Yeah.
What other Cars have you got? A Cars blanket?
Yeah. I also have Lightning McQueen.
You just the car. How many?
Yeah, I have like two of
them. How many figurines of Cars? I mean, the actual Cars, toy cars of Cars do we have in this house?
I don't know.
There's a lot, but it's a hugely marketed angle of the Disney machine. So, you know, overall, I thought this had heart. The animation, of course, was fantastic. But you come to expect that for Pixar. Nothing should look second rate when it comes to a Pixar movie. There's a lot to the story. It takes a long time to kind of get through. It's not like a breezy 80-minute movie, is it? It wasn't too short, was it?
No.
Let's just move on to the grade because we're running out of time here. What do you give Cars 3 as a grade? Kind of rocks, kind of sucks.
Rocks.
Rocks. Rocks, just totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
I'm going to say it kind of rocks just because I fell asleep a couple times, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't get yourself in trouble.
I won't get myself in trouble. But you said it rocked.
Yes.
I said it kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk real quickly about the box office. My prediction last week was that there would be $50 million for Wonder Woman and $40 million for The Mummy. The Mummy did a lot worse than that. Wonder Woman actually did a little bit better. And you know, we can talk a lot about the failure of The Mummy. It just did not click with American audiences, although it was the biggest opening Tom Cruise had worldwide. He only made like under $32 million in the States, but it's doing really well overseas, which is essentially the same pattern, not at the same numbers, but the same pattern you saw with the Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Wonder Woman, though, is more interesting because it had over $58 million its second weekend, and that was a drop of only 43%, which is an incredible hold, to the point that if you compare Wonder Woman with the rest of the DC Extended Universe movies, Wonder Woman is making now, day-to-day, better than any of the other movies. There was, like, the first weekend, like, the first 4 days, it was other movies doing better. But if you look just raw numbers, even adjusted numbers for inflation, Wonder Woman is doing better in its, like, 10th, 11th, 12th day. In the end, it's definitely going to top Man of Steel in the final box office, but it actually may outdo Batman versus Superman and Suicide Squad, which I didn't think it was going to do. But that's an impressive hold for Wonder Woman. So, you know, good for Wonder Woman. The Mummy, not so well in America, but it's still a hit overseas. And then It Comes at Night made less than $6 million in the weekend, which is important because everybody was saying, oh, hey, good reviews propel a movie to great. Well, no, not this time. It Comes at Night had great reviews. It got a D from audiences. I think audiences and what they think of a movie tend to drive the box office numbers more than anything else. And then Megan Levy did okay with less than $4 million and less than $1 million for My Cousin Rachel. This week, I think you're going to get a good solid $60 million for Cars 3. But even if it underperforms, remember what I said in the review, when people start screaming bomb, just remember that the Disney merchandising arm makes billions of dollars off of the Cars merchandise. And that's why they make these movies. They could make zero on these movies. And as long as it drove people to buy stuff that had Lightning McQueen on it, they're still going to make the movies. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today, we are going to focus on the Lego Batman movie, and I've actually kept around Nicholas Carr here to talk a little bit about that. But before we do, let's hit the trailer really quick. In this side sequel to the Lego movie from 2014, we see Batman struggling with terms of family and enemies.
Master Bruce, your greatest fear is...
Snakes?
No.
Clouds?
No. It's being a part of a family again.
No, now it's snake clouds because you put that idea in my head.
Sir, you need to take responsibility for your life, and it starts by raising the young orphan you adopted.
Whee! Hello, secret camera.
Hi, Batman!
No way!
Come catch your greatest enemy.
Superman is my greatest enemy.
Superman's not a bad guy!
Give me what you thought of the Lego Batman movie.
It was good. The Lego building is incredible.
Lots of really good animation.
I do not know how they can build that whole city.
Well, it's in a computer.
Yeah.
But they do a bit brick by brick. They literally build it brick by brick. So that's impressive. You'd like to have that in your basement.
Yeah.
To knock over and break, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you like this more or less than the Lego movie?
More.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, because it didn't do as well as the Lego movie, but I think that's because it had more of a narrow focus. It was a movie about just Batman and what was going on, as opposed to the Lego movie, which kind of had cameos from everyone from Star Wars, even though they had a bunch of cameos in the Phantom Zone, the bad guys.
Yeah.
Like Sauron,
who's
the big eye.
What was he from?
He's from the Lord of the Rings. Hmm. All right, so now, the thing, though, is because this is a DVD and a Blu-ray, let's talk about the special features. What were some cool things in the special features? Because it's more and more I've been seeing movies doing less and less stuff on the bonus features, but there is some good stuff here. What do you want to talk about really quickly in terms of the bonus features? The animated shorts?
Yeah, I like the animated shorts.
Yeah.
They were awesome.
Yeah, they're just
they
fun.
They were funny.
They continued more of the silliness of the Batman movie, right?
Yes.
The other thing I really liked about the Blu-ray of the Lego Batman movie are the deleted scenes. The deleted scenes, they had a lot of good stuff in there, didn't they?
Yeah.
And sometimes deleted scenes are kind of lame. Sometimes deleted scenes are, you understand why they were. And there was one with Barbara Gordon singing because Mariah Carey does the voice for her.
Yeah.
That one was kind of stupid.
Yeah.
But the other ones that were pretty fun. I mean, it was, I didn't feel like I was wasting my time watching the deleted scenes.
Yeah.
And they showed the Rebrick winners. Did you like that? The little short little Lego films that people made, fans made?
Oh, yeah.
Is there anything else you wanted to hit of stuff that you liked about the Lego Batman movie?
Well, when Joker said, I'm rubbing my butt all over your stuff.
Well, that was from the... Anything that mentions butt, like...
We should call this the Buttmobile.
Nice. So you want to see the Lego Buttman movie when they make it sometime?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Good to know. But no, this actually has some really nice behind-the-scenes stuff, and then of course there's a commentary track which you don't have on everything, but you didn't want to listen to the commentary track. So what do you say is your rating for the Lego Batman?
Rock.
Rocks?
Yeah.
All right.
It rocks.
Excellent.
The other DVDs and Blu-rays that are out this week are John Wick 2, South Park Season 20, which is kind of terrible, so I don't know if that's worth getting, and Grimm Season 6. That's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Transformers, The Last Knight, and The Beguiled. And until then,
have a fat time at the movies.